From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The fact that China was committed to territorial integrity, committed to equality, committed to recognizing the developmental challenges of countries like ours, made it a natural fit for us to agree to form what we call a China-SADC conference. And this is the first meeting of it here in China.
That was Prime Minister Perry Christie of the Bahamas in an exclusive interview with CCTV as the first ministerial meeting of the China-SADC Forum concluded in Beijing. Prime Minister Christie was one of a delegation of senior ministers and heads of state from Latin America and the Caribbean in attendance at the two-day summit in the Chinese capital.
What does this conference actually want to tell?
We meet to share our vision for development, to bring focus on the fact that we have common areas that need the attention of governments and that we can find much more sort of strength in being able to come together as a region to be able to represent ourselves in the world block of companies. When we met with China, the suggestion was that China was an emerging nation with a huge purchasing power, extraordinary reserves, a major source for investment funds, and that China, therefore, was a natural partner.
More and more Chinese investors would ask the same question as to whether it's safe to make investment in your country. Can you assure the Chinese investors?
I hope you heard me when I said China has received many contracts to build roads under the concessional lending. And this conference today demonstrates very clearly the confidence of the Chinese government and the confidence of governments of Latin America, Central America, and the Caribbean in the Chinese people and the Chinese currency and the Chinese commitment. And so we're beyond that now, and most certainly in the Bahamas, our reputation is much too important to squander over decisions that are not best interest decisions in the country. We protect the investment of people. We value that. That is what our country's reputation is based upon.
What do you want to say to the Chinese viewers?
China, being a tremendous country as it is, ought to be able to support us. You send millions of people abroad looking for holidays. We want you to come to the Bahamas because 70% of our country economy is triggered by tourism. We say that if you have wealthy Chinese who would wish to bank in the Bahamas, we have products in the Bahamas that would attract you. We say that. But we also say that there are opportunities for you to invest in the Bahamas and have a good return on your investment. That is the Bahamas we know, that is the Bahamas we love, and that is the Bahamas that I represent today here in the People's Republic of China.
China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi said his country will use big country diplomacy to promote the establishment of a common destiny with Latin American countries. We have this report from the Chinese news agency, CCTV.
Airing a strong voice together through a fruitful meeting with significant influence and taking the cooperation projects from theory into reality. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi addresses media after the two-day talks with Latin American leaders. Wang Yi said China and the SADC members endorsed the three major documents, including a Beijing Declaration, a cooperation plan for 2015 to 2019, and a document which organizes the mechanisms of the China-SADC Forum. The five-year cooperation plan covers 13 major sectors, including political security, trade, investment, finance, infrastructure, energy, resources, industry, agriculture, science and technology, and people-to-people exchanges. Wang Yi also answered the only question from the Chinese media, raised by CCTV News.
That's a good question. China and the Latin American countries are all developing countries. Although geographically there's a long distance between us, we're naturally good cooperative partners. The sides have deep traditional friendships which have been growing from the mutual support between the two peoples. Second, we have the same political pursuits. Both sides are important forces behind safeguarding world peace, security and development. Third, the two sides have similar development plans and are willing to strengthen exchanges on development and governance. Fourth, we are economically complementary to each other, development potential with abundant natural resources, and China is the world's second largest economy.
After the joint news conference, the Latin American media are very keen to see the fruitful results.
I think China has been a pillar in all this, because without China, it will be impossible. You know, Latin America has the resources, but China has the finances and the experience and the science and technology that Latin America needs.
There is a lack of infrastructure in the Latin America. It's not only Latin America, it's the whole world. And China is ready to invest in these projects in Latin America. And I think that this will be the most promising area of cooperation between China and Latin America.
Meanwhile, as China moves closer to the global south and begins to use its economic and financial might as an engine of global development, in the U.S. and EU, most workers still remain in the throes of the economic collapse of 2008, with many Americans wondering how this happened and why. Black Agenda Report's Glenn Ford offers his take in this commentary.
12 years ago, the people who rule the United States wagered the fate of its decaying empire on a lightning military strike into the Middle East, beginning with the rapid conquest of Iraq. From there, the Americans planned to project imperial power deep into energy-rich Central Asia, allowing Washington to isolate and strangle China, which was then only a few years away from becoming the world's largest economy. America's pivotal ally in the region was Saudi Arabia, the most reactionary regime on the face of the earth, and a client state of the U.S. since the end of World War II. Instead of containing China, the Americans accelerated the processes of their own ruin, as I predicted on the very day they invaded Iraq. George Bush's successor, Barack Obama, called it a dumb war. But in fact, the Iraq war was a calculated act of desperate men, based on the inescapable facts of imperial decline and the logic of class survival. It was a war in which the potential damage to U.S. power and prestige in the world was weighed and measured against the consequences of allowing China to continue its rise, possibly in a future partnership with Russia, creating a new nexus of economic and political collaboration that would draw in Brazil, India, Latin America, and eventually even Europe. In other words, U.S. imperialism looked into the near future and saw its own death. It chose not to die, but to preemptively reset the global chessboard, knowing full well that failure in Iraq would hasten the pace of imperial decline. George Bush rolled the dice and lost. But that's what any ruling class would do when staring death in the face. Barack Obama, who answers to the same masters as Bush, entered office confronting the same scenario as his predecessor, only from an even weaker position. Obama chose to spread chaos through proxy jihadist wars in North Africa and the Middle East in partnership with Saudi Arabia. But the pace of imperial decline had quickened decisively with the financial meltdown. Chaos is an unreliable weapon, and jihadists are no friends of Wall Street bankers or Saudi royalty. China is acknowledged as the economic top dog, with Russia as a partner and the rest of the world reconfiguring itself. Death is still breathing down U.S. imperialism's neck. And so Barack Obama, like George Bush before him, rolls the dice of war. His partner, once again, is Saudi Arabia, without which the breathtaking plunge in oil prices could not have occurred. This time around, Washington aims to cripple Russia before moving against China by destabilizing the whole world's energy sector, including U.S. energy production. But that's like setting your apartment on fire to get rid of an unwanted roommate. There's no way to calibrate and control such an assault on energy pricing, no possible means of avoiding a cascade of unintended consequences to the world economy. If the war against Iraq was dumb, the oil price war is the mother of dementia and cannot help but further unravel all manner of capitalist structures, including deadly derivatives throughout the planet. But doomed systems and declining classes will do anything to forestall the inevitable. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Tribute was held at the UN in Geneva to the victims of a shooting at a Paris magazine. Daniel Johnson reports from Geneva.
Representatives from the UN and France, along with journalists, paid tribute to the victims of the Paris terrorist attack in a ceremony at the Palais des Nations in Geneva on Friday. Director General of United Nations in Geneva, Michael Muller, called for a minute's silence as reporters gathered for a briefing by humanitarian agencies.
Today, we honour the victims all through silence, but we will truly honour their memory by speaking up and speaking out, because true courage lies in an open exchange of view, and true respect for others comes through dialogue.
He called Wednesday's armed assault on satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo horrendous. Mr. Muller also reacted to the news that two Tunisian journalists had been reportedly killed in Libya this morning by Islamic State. He sent his sympathies to the families of Sofiane Chirabi and Nadia Qatari, as well as those killed in the French assault. Also present at the ceremony was High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Raad Al Hussein.
What fell upon Paris two mornings ago was an awful crime. The right to the freedom of expression has always been considered as that human right which best answers to the wickedness brought on by tyranny and racism of the sort that contributed greatly to the Second World War. That right, the freedom of expression, must therefore be argued for vigorously, most especially by this organization, by me, by us.
He said that as a Muslim, many satirical cartoons produced after the attack were as offensive to him as they were to the 1.6 billion Muslims around the world. But he insisted that the answer was not to respond to such cartoons with violence, as this would be abominable. Daniel Johnson, United Nations.
But as the West has led a chorus of outrage over the apparent threat to freedom of the press, they say was represented by the murder of a dozen people at the offices of a racist satire publication in France. A much larger assault on the press that has been taking place across the border in Mexico has received little or no attention from the media, the UN, or Washington. Mexico has seen 139 journalists killed over the last 14 years, or nearly one per month since the turn of the century. The latest victim, journalist activist Moises Sanchez, was abducted from his home in the state of Veracruz by armed men on January 2nd of this year. Sanchez writes for a newspaper in the city of Medellin and is known for his coverage of drug-related violence and corruption. Telesur's Clayton Kahn reports from Mexico City.
Fellow journalist students and the family of the abducted journalist and activist Moises Sanchez continued their protest in his hometown of Medellin de Bravo. They say his reporting activism against local corruption made him an uncomfortable subject for the authorities.
We are yet to receive a threat or a phone call demanding ransom. Nothing. This is precisely because we know what his work is. We know that being a reporter is very dangerous in Veracruz. They may even disappear you, or you might have an accident.
Journalists and reporters also expressed their solidarity in the Mexican capital, protesting in front of the Veracruz State Representative Building. They say the case of Sanchez is not an isolated or a local matter.
A government that acts transparently does not need to target journalists. But when there are cases of corruption, siphoning of money and repression, the government will turn to silence in the press.
Experts say that Mexico is one of the most dangerous countries for journalists to work, pointing to an approximately 90% impunity rate in cases of murdered media workers. According to media watchdog and rights groups, more than 50 journalists have been killed in the country since it launched its so-called drug war in 2006, and more than a third of those have been in the state of Veracruz. Clayton Khan de la Sur.
Here in the U.S., the movement to end police brutality, sparked by a series of high-profile cases of police killings of unarmed black men, has become, apparently, just that, a movement. Journalist Susan Medaris is based in New York and produces a weekly program called Inside Out for Press TV. This week, that program took a look at some of the issues involved in the movement, and we bring you these excerpts from that now.
We're coming to you from New York City, where thousands of demonstrators have taken to the streets in recent months, protesting what they call injustice and police brutality. They want to see reform. These protests have sprung nationwide from Los Angeles to Washington and hundreds of other cities after the recent killings of two unarmed African-American men by the hands of the police, one in Staten Island, New York, and the other in Ferguson, Missouri. They marched the streets to remind America that Black Lives Matter.
This was the amateur video that quickly went viral of an officer choking Eric Garner to death on July 17th. Garner was approached by the police for allegedly selling loose cigarettes. The 43-year-old African-American father of six can be heard gasping, "I can't breathe," was later pronounced dead at a nearby hospital in Staten Island, New York. Less than a month later, on August 9th, Officer Darren Wilson opened fire on an unarmed African-American teenager. 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot to death in the suburb of Ferguson, Missouri. Both Brown and Garner's killers were freed by their respective grand juries with no indictments. The decision sent shockwaves across the country.
A grand jury would indict a ham sandwich. The point of it is that that level is a level that is almost a taken-for-granted level, so that's what they would indict. So the failure to indict is, of course, an incredible situation.
After the non-indictment of these two high-profile cases, streets across the United States erupted in demonstrations, again and again, with anger, protests, and the pain of perhaps realizing that justice is unequally applied based on the color of the skin.
I was surprised by the level of activity. It's basically fueled a movement that's focused on broadly social justice and racial justice, but very specifically on abusive police practices and the lack of accountability that's applied to the police when they engage in misconduct or excessive force, even deadly force.
Another black man is dead at the hands of the NYPD. This has been going on far too long. Activists have been marching until their shoes are worn out over the deaths at the hands of the NYPD. And by prosecuting or firing the individual police officers involved, it is not addressing the systemic culture of brutality in the NYPD. We must go farther. We must ask for a change that's deep and fundamental. The top brass of the NYPD needs to pay a price.
And it's been decades, even if not longer than decades, of abusive police practices that cops have essentially, and police departments have essentially gotten away with in regard to their treatment of people of color, particularly black people. It's laid, all that time, in effect, has laid a kind of groundwork of dry sticks, in New York City and across the country. And for reasons that I don't fully understand, the Ferguson incident, the Eric Garner incident, and then the no indictments in response to the killings of unarmed black men was like the match and the gasoline poured on the dry sticks.
Officer has engaged the suspect vehicle in pursuit. Confirmed. Pursuit engaged. All units be advised, we have a pursuit in progress. Units are not equipped to call the direct to the clear. Stand by to assist. Attention to all units. Officers require assistance.
Roger that.
And the issue just blew up, I mean, obviously, figuratively speaking, and has led to this extraordinary movement. The people in the streets, again, all over the country.
Robert Ganji served as executive director of the Correctional Association for over 29 years and founded the Police Reform Organizing Project, PROP, at the Urban Justice Center in April 2011. Mr. Ganji has been an activist, community organizer, and public policy advocate in New York City for over 40 years. He is a recognized expert on criminal justice and law enforcement issues, with a particular focus on police and prison concerns. Ganji says it's important to point out this is not about every individual police officer, but the policies and practices of the department that facilitates unequal treatment of vulnerable groups.
The one clear thing that's changed is the videos. Clearly in the Eric Garner case, the video showed police, we know that the police officer did not intend to kill Eric Garner, but the video showed the excessive use of force, almost used in a cavalier way, how they left his, what turned out to be lifeless body on the street, unattended to after he had said 11 times, I can't breathe. What people of color will tell you and told me is that is not necessarily a daily thing, but that kind of thing is fairly common, where police use excessive force and have a casual disregard for the well-being of people of color. Part of what's different now is the videos, and when people across the country, across the city, see those videos, including prosperous white people who have no experience with the police behaving badly, it's eye-opening, it's educational, and people react to it. It's similar in a way to what helped trigger the success of the civil rights movement in the 60s was the TV news coverage of the dogs and the hoses being turned on the civil rights demonstrators in Birmingham, Alabama.
Ironically, in the year that was heralded the 50th anniversary of the passage of the Civil Rights Act, the landmark legislation which set the foundation for expanding and protecting civil liberties for African Americans, that these demonstrations have to reaffirm that Black lives matter and require legal protection too, 50 years on.
Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter!
Here in New York City, protesters have gathered once again, vowing to not back down until their demands are met. Many of the protesters that I talked to today said one of the things they want to see is equal representation in law enforcement and the government. They also want to make clear that they're not anti-police, they're anti-police brutality.
According to a recent nationwide analysis by USA Today, blacks are far more likely to be arrested than any other racial group in the United States. In some places, dramatically so. At least 70 departments scattered from Connecticut to California arrested black people at a rate 10 times higher than people who are not black. Nationwide, blacks are stopped, searched, arrested, and imprisoned at rates higher than people of other races. USA Today's analysis using arrests reported to the federal government in 2011 and 2012 found that those inequalities are far wider in many cities across the country, from Atlanta to Michigan, from Ferguson to New York.
Out of the 179 cases, there have been 3 indictments, 1 conviction, and the convicted officer didn't do any jail or prison time. Those numbers alone, plus what we've seen in Ferguson and Staten Island, should provide enough support for the case that we reformers are making for the politicians to listen and to institute independent offices in different parts of the country that will prosecute cases of police brutality. So that's one very important change. Very important change in New York City, which I could speak most knowledgeably about, is to significantly change day-to-day police practice.
These disparities are often easier to measure than they are to explain.
Well, the reason the protests have grown is because there are so many diverse incidents. You have to take them individually, but when you can look at them collectively and say, something's wrong, something's very wrong. And the point I would emphasize, that my view on what connects them all, is a lack of training for the police, a lack of professionalism in how they handle a weapon and when they use deadly force. If we begin with Ferguson and we take as truth what the FBI found in forensic and in what the officer Wilson said, we have some problems. And the first one is that he reaches for his gun when he feels threatened and he's unable to fire it twice. Right away at that point you knew here's a man that doesn't know how to use his weapon. He hasn't mastered it. Then we find him, if we accept the fact that he was really menaced and he fires the first shot, the second shot, it's very hard to explain all the rest. You're basically seeing someone who emptied a clip shooting wildly. So this is a lack of what's called in the military fire discipline. So what we had, and then we had in New York, the chokehold, this thing, you had five officers present, including a sergeant. So you had a lot of command, that you had a chain of command right there, authority. You had a large, five is an awful lot of police to be on hand. And to allow this to happen and carry on is a major problem in training. The problems in training are what links most of these actions.
61-year-old Peter Sennett was in the Marine Corps in his early 20s. He didn't go to Vietnam, but he did complete infantry training. He tells me that when he went to advanced infantry training, he fired 500 rounds in 1 month from his M16.
In what's called boot camp, these extra weeks of training, that's what distinguishes Marine Corps basic training from the other services, that we got to really learn to control fire. And this lack of being able to control a weapon, to utilize a weapon, to understand deadly force, is a very terrifying link between many of these cases. So we have several cases, even in New York City over the past 15 years, 20 years, of massive amounts of bullets being fired needlessly. So the idea of real training and taking it seriously and making that a component of how you judge whether someone should be a policeman, whether they should maintain the status of being a policeman, is something that's missing. It's all about training and it's all about focusing on what are responsibilities of policemen and when do you use deadly force.
The death by cop of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Eric Garner in Staten Island, New York, became the two high-profile cases. But between then and now, Akai Gurley in a Brooklyn housing project and 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland, Ohio, have also made headlines as unarmed African Americans who were killed by the police. While these deaths have been in the news lately, the deep-seated suspicion against the police and government authority among minority communities, as my guests mentioned, has been building up for many years.
The local district attorneys will usually, there'll be exceptions, usually will not take cases of police brutality and, in effect, criminal behavior by the police seriously enough. There's a conflict of interest. The district attorneys work with the police departments on a daily basis. Anyone who watches Law and Order knows that. District attorneys in New York City, and I assume in most parts of the country, are politicians. They're elected.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.